I love when you turn on the Zoom, it says, hi. It welcomes you every time you turn it on.
Well, you know, they want to make it less of an impersonal machine. It's like how Macs used to have, at least, a little happy face Mac.
Don't they still have that when they come on?
No, it's an Apple.
Oh, it is the Apple now. That's right. How much I pay attention to the boot up screen.
So, how was your week?
It was good. Busy, as usual, as these weeks tend to be. I wish springtime would come around. That would be nice.
It's technically spring.
Yeah, we had a snowstorm the day after spring.
We had some interesting weather yesterday. There was, for a period of time, it was like this snow-rain mix, but didn't accumulate any, so.
Yeah, so, yeah, but I don't know. On my side of the city yesterday, it was a heavy, heavy snow for about an hour and a half. It didn't really accumulate, yeah. Right? But, yeah, but I mean, it was like snowstorm. What the fuck?
Yeah. But it was, it was 36.
Especially when I woke up in the morning and my phone said, today, a high of 52.
It was 36 degrees outside. It wasn't going to stick at all. So it was just weather poking its head out saying, hey, winter, I'm not done yet.
How'd you celebrate the solstice?
I celebrated by forgetting about it. And then I realized the day afterwards it was a solstice.
The day after the solstice. Damn it, I missed it.
So, yeah.
So when they say when the solstice happens, they say it's at a specific moment. I was trying to figure out how that works, but I guess it does make sense, right? Because the terminus will be at 90 degrees, like, or from pole to pole, right? No, not pole. Yeah.
Well, yes.
So I'm trying to look at the geography, right. Or not geography.
There would be a specific moment in time where it's within a certain degree of error, but the terminus is at a specific point, but that's on a geodesic. But that's
okay. So the pole axis will be perpendicular to the sun right then, right? So it's still tilted, right? But it's 90 degrees to the sun, right? Because when the north pole is pointing towards the sun, right, that summer, south pole towards winter. So that's what it is. The pole's still tilted, but it's 90 degrees like this to the sun, right? Instead of, if it was like this, it wouldn't be 90. This wouldn't be 90. So that's okay. So I guess there is an exact period where it's at 90.0000 degrees.
Right.
So that would be the solstice. But the way the solstice is.
But it's not a. But it's the not way a solstice is an equinox.
I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Forgive me. but see, what confused me is the way the equinox is defined is 12 hours of sunlight, 12 hours of dark, right? They don't define. They don't so much define it as when the polar axis is perpendicular to
the sun. The legitimate scientific definition is when the polar axis is, but the colloquial definition is 12 and 12.
Right.
So, that's like the colloquial definition of theory is, a guess.
Right.
Whereas the scientific definition of theory is a much different thing.
So, now I can see where there's an exact moment. Mm-hmm. That is the equinox. But, when you're thinking about, everyone has a day that's 12 and 12, right? So, how do you know the exact moment? But now I get it. Okay. We're drinking the Saranac Pale Ale.
I love pale ales. I like pale ales a lot.
Saranac's an old, Saranac Pale Ale was around when I first started getting into craft beer. Mm-hmm. And, we've talked about Saranac a bunch, about how they've really turned the corner, right? Scott, friend of mine.
At this point, we can't even say they turned the corner. They've been good for a while.
They've been good for a while, right? But historically, I remember I heard a quote from a friend who said, Saranac always confused me. A bunch of different labels, and it seemed like the same beer was in every bar.
Right, right.
But for a long time, not only because we get free beer from them,
This was free. This was sent to us.
Yes. We think Saranac's doing some good stuff now. This will be the first time I've had pale ale in. Well, no, I've probably had a sample from them.
No, I've had it, you know, because back when I was drinking beer more often, I would get cases of Saranac. I like the variety. I like variety packs because, especially when you had to buy cases, you know, you're not actually buying 24 of one specific beer. So,
So this one's has good malt flavor, also good hoppiness. First sip came across a little bit cidery, though. Let's see if I can.
It's a little pithy, a little bit of grapefruit pith.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it was just the first sip needing to calibrate. All right, so Community.
Yes.
Been watching Community. So there was the second to last episode, which was VCR repair, right? And that was, I didn't realize that was Terry Gilligan, or Vince Gilligan.
Vince Gilligan.
Till the after the credits scene, or, you know, the coda. I didn't notice it was him until the coda. And then like, oh my God, that's awesome.
So that is the second showrunner in as many weeks on the show.
Right. Bang, bang.
Tornado coming.
And then, so the most recent one was a role playing, right? Well, Dungeons and Dragons.
Too, yeah.
Advanced Dungeons and Dragons was the title.
Yeah.
And that one was pretty good. It's you know, I've never played D&D on a table with dice, but you know, I've been playing Sloth Mud a little bit, you know, here and there. Yeah. And you know, it's all statistic based too, right? So like you're watching them do this stuff, and I could relate more than I would have been able to otherwise.
Yeah.
And oh man, Abed's a good dungeon master.
Abed's probably one of the better dungeon masters, absolutely.
He's like, you're not making this easy. I wouldn't be a good dungeon master if I was.
It's hard to pull off a sequel, and they cop to that in one, yeah. You know, they're so meta about it. Of course, they're going to mention it. What they did is they changed the circumstances entirely. In order to make it, you know, so it's not just doing the same beats over and over again. In fact, you know, it's a radically different set of beats. It just happens to be around a Dungeons and Dragons game.
Right.
So that was...
The first one was where they were rolling the dice and it was changing their, like...
No. That was
a different one.
That was... that was the Timelines episode.
Okay, so I'm not sure I remember the... First D&D one.
It was in the second season. It was called Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay. I assumed that much.
It was Pierce was the evil guy, and they were trying to save Fat Neil.
I'll have to go find it.
Wow. That is probably my favorite episode of Community. Probably, I think, the best episode of Community ever.
I'm sure if I see it, I'll remember it.
Yeah.
But I'm having a hard time remembering it now.
And the episode that got me into D&D. The episode that wow, there's something to this idea. There's something, you know, like I've said this before I watched that episode, I thought D&D, you know, you're looking at your sheets and you're writing down things or something, and that's all you're doing at rolling dice. I didn't realize that it was really a very social interaction between people, and you're making up this sort of group adventure. And when I saw that, because all the other shows that had tried to tackle D&D, they had D&D as sort of an ancillary plotline, but didn't actually have the players playing D&D. This was people actually playing the game, and it seemed like a pretty fun thing to try to do.
Right.
You know, it's all dependent on how well everyone wants to play it and how, you know, your dungeon master is, but... It seemed like it'd be fun, and yeah, it turns out it is. It turns out it's the same thing as having it, like we said, having a poker night.
I love, you know, in the most recent one, it was really great how they had set up the whole scenario, right? And they, you know, he's like, I want to do that, change it. He's like, the tower's to the west. Well, I want to go east. What's east? You know, and you know, it was off plan, but, you know, it was really great how the Abed character countered to it, right? Oh, nice.
This is the full Matt from the episode.
It was really great how Abed's character, who, well, he didn't want to do it at first, he embraced the Dungeon Master role.
Yeah,
and, I mean, and made a story around
a good
what
Dungeon Master would be like. Yeah, well, okay. You know, there is, you're dropped in a world, and there may be, in the D&D games that I've played, at least, the idea that there was a goal was something we had to find. Mm-hmm. It isn't presented to you outright. You're dropped into a world. You're kind of, you know, you have the assumption that you're heroes and you're looking for something, and there will be somebody who offers some sort of quest, usually a bunch of different quests, like one big one and a whole bunch of little ones. And of course, you're dealing with five plus people. There is an overriding, like, let's say there is one thing, you need to kill, in this case it was the evil necromancer in this show, but whatever it is, whatever your goal is, you maybe will kill two monsters.
What did Hickey call the necromancer?
I forget, but it was funny. You'll maybe kill, have two monster encounters in a night. So you maybe will be done with the campaign over the course of about 7 months. If you're doing it once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't accomplish something in one session. It's slow going. You're doing a lot of talking back and forth, doing a lot of joking around.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I've never been in a group that's just focused and serious about the game, period.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you were, it still takes time to do all this stuff. I mean, and, you know, another difference is, of course, in the community episode, Abed's going to one rolling the dice in regular community, in regular D&D.
Regular community.
In regular D&D, you roll the dice for your character when they do certain things. Like when they, if you do a reflex check or if you do an initiative roll or attack roll, you're rolling the dice. So. But the Dungeon Master still has dice to roll for other things.
Right.
But it's really, when you get a good Dungeon Master, and really you just need a good, really creative person behind there who's willing to tell a story and willing to take the story wherever you want to go.
I guess the D&D guidebook is mostly so the Dungeon Master can put together a good difficulty, like, you know, like, character is this level.
Well, I mean,
like, because, like, if you're just making it all up on the fly, I mean, unless you're an awesome Dungeon Master, I could see where it'd be really hard to, you know, say, you know, like, figure out the...
Yeah, I mean...
The strength of the enemy type thing.
Well, there's absolutely some of that. There's you know, monster guides, and there's a Dungeon Master's guide and stuff like that. I haven't read them, but tell the Dungeon Master, you know, how to build the best sort of encounter. It's, you know, what they call
it. Well, it's like, okay, so you got, you know, say you got three people grouping, right? And you want to have this demon, right? How strong do you need to make the demon to make it a difficult challenge for three people of these levels rolling
usually
the dice, that kind of thing?
You wouldn't create your own enemy, except for like the very last enemy. You would use enemies that have already been created. You can create your own if you want to. But yeah, I mean, you would refer back to, you know, okay, they're level one or level two. What should they be fighting? Versus, you know, if you're level seven, you should be fighting something completely different than if you're level one or two.
Right.
You're considerably more powerful at level seven. My Pathfinder character is a level four thief right now. Probably be level four for at least two more runs.
Man, you're slow. I'm a triple 20 on Sloth Mud. I ranked up 8 million XP today.
D&D is a slower affair. But you can have a lot of fun and a lot of fun moments, both in the game and outside of the game.
Mm-hmm.
It just is fun, and, you know, like any group activity, if the group is decided on doing something, usually that will become fun if you're with the group and you want to do it. So so why wouldn't it be fun?
Yeah, I think it's I mean, Yeah, I mean, if you've ever played, you know, I've been playing the mod, so like now I can appreciate more what the D&D story would be, right?
Mm-hmm.
As long as, you know, you have, like you said, you have a good dungeon master, right? You know, you can't have, I couldn't make the challenges compelling, fair, slot, you know, all that stuff, right? You need someone who knows, you know, a level one typically loses hit points at this ratio, right? So you can, like, you know, because the better you are, you'll know those kinds of things, right?
Yeah,
so.
There's average. But you're thinking too much on the numbers, whereas, you know, there's a lot of... You're playing your character a little bit, too. My first character was, for instance, a mage, and so he was a different sort of character than the character as a thief. Like, mm-hmm. like I play my character as a thief, always looking for an out, always looking for a way to steal something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm always asking, you know, is there something around that I can steal? You know, or, you know, I'm always looking for that.
Right.
While I'm playing the character, whereas while I was playing the mage, it was... I'm a glass cannon. I have to...
Lightning bolt!
It's a different situation when you're playing different types of characters. When I played a barbarian for a very short period of time, but that was very much a character where... Not a lot of thinking involved when you're making decisions. The game actually is more fun when people sort of embrace their characters, because if someone, you know, it's not the person, it's the character. So when they play their character, that leads to interesting situations where if you have somebody who's like a holy guy and somebody who's like a necromancer in the same party, there's difficulties, as there should be. So. It's fun to have that level of interaction, because it's a lot like improv, in a way.
Right.
You're building up a character and then you're bouncing these characters off of each other. That has nothing to do with rolling the dice, too. That's just how you think a person like this would approach a situation.
Right. Cool.
Let's see. The head of the Westboro chapter church died, but he wasn't actually the head anymore. Oh, that's a weird story.
I heard the headline.
Yes. So Fred Phelps, the guy from the God Hates Fags Church.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know what the deal was. Okay.
He's dead, but apparently he was kicked out of the church, or at least out of the leadership position in the church for over a year. The only thing I know about the Westboro Baptist Church, other than, you know, they protest things, is that there was a really good group of duo of documentaries from the BBC about them. Really very, very interesting people. Very, you know, it's a good documentary will make you feel for the characters even if you don't like them. And that was the way, you know, I felt bad for them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, because especially for most of them, because most of them were just sort of caught up in this. And this is all they know. Like, especially the kids. It really is just a group of like three families, and their extended families, and you know, the kids. That's all they're brought up in. So they have nothing. Their entire worldview is this way,
right?
And it's just, you know, it's awful to think that people have to go through that, and at the same time, I can see why, if you're brought up in that situation, it'd be really hard to say, oh, well, I can rationalize my way out of this. Not really. You know, it's difficult when you're in that sheltered situation, mm-hmm. and you're being preached to constantly. Yeah, so without getting it too much into it, because it is, I confess, something I just don't know that much about. The entire situation is crazy, but I don't think this will stop them. So,
week three, or the third time we've talked about the Malaysian Airlines flight.
Yeah. Still missing.
Do you, so they're searching.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of a follow-up case you're listening to us much later, but right now, last couple of days, you know, they saw the satellite photo that suggests that they might have seen some large things floating like at the surface of the water way the fuck south of Australia, but it actually kind of lines up with the southern track of the triangulation of the satellite pings. So the last 3 days they've been searching. I didn't see any news today. There's no new news today, is there?
The Chinese may have found a photo of some debris, but no one actually found anything besides photos of something that may look like, you know, it's unidentifiable, but it could possibly be something. It's something floating. It could be anything. I don't know. At this point, the only thing that... There's so many theories out there, but the thing that makes the most sense to me, the idea, based on all that I've heard, and like a lot of things I was basing on about it, about the possibility of being hijacked, were based on the Malaysian government telling us things that have been later recanted, like the idea that somebody turned off the stuff before they said goodnight, and then it turns out that that's not true. I have no idea what happened.
Yeah, the Malaysian authorities aren't very good at running an investigation.
No. I have no idea what happened. The thing that makes the most sense, to me at least, is that there was some problem on board, like say a fire, and there was smoke coming from somewhere, so they had to shut off some systems. And the very first thing you do, and that apparently I was reading some aviation forums, and they say, aviate, navigate, communicate. That's the order. So the very first thing you do in that situation is get a handle on what you're doing. And so he's tried to turn back to at least a
runway. I read that one. It was in a rough heading of one of the closest runways that he could land at, right? Not where it took off from, but there was a runway.
And at some point, they got overwhelmed by probably like smoke inhalation, and the plane was then...
Do you think the plane was just flying itself?
Just flying. It's a fly-by-wire plane, so if it will keep itself level, even without autopilot. And so, you know, it got onto something and then just stayed on that track. And that happened to be pointing south at that time.
So you don't think... So the radar, the last radar tracker I've seen, you know, it turned west, and then it kind of dipped south, and it turned north, right?
Right.
You don't think that north turn is accurate, or...
I don't think that can be... That north turn itself, I thought, was sort of iffy.
Okay.
But it's... I mean, I don't know what the situation was, but the reason why I think it turned south is the like thing is not because the debris was found there, because there's no radar there. And so it'd be easier for something to get lost there.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of radar in the range, even though this is not all on. You'd think, and there's lots of people, well, there's enough people, you'd think that they would see something if it were flying over land at some point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
And if it was flying for 7 hours, or at least operating for 7 hours, and it got to somewhere on this arc, well, it had to be flying for a significant amount of that time. And so, yeah, I don't, that's the thing that makes the most sense to me. But again, that could be, you know,
it does make sense, right? It takes out a lot of conspiracy.
Yeah.
And, like before you said that, I was confused. I didn't see, like, I was thinking that actually that makes so much, that's the most plausible thing by far, because like, okay, the plane crashed way the fuck out there. If you're going to commit, you know, suicide by pilot, why do it out there? Why not just do it right where you're at, you know? So I thought that was curious, right? But no, I mean, I think your hypothesis, your speculation mitigates all of the crazy-ass theories.
Like I said, it's the thing that makes the most sense. It doesn't mean that it's the thing that's true.
Right.
It just means this thing makes... Would you like to...
Yeah, sure, we can open that. Yeah. I mean, it's really the simple... I mean... Right, it's the simplest thing that explains the evidence so far. Because nothing, I mean, everything else that explains the evidence is not simple.
Right, it's the Occam's razor. To a point. I mean, you're still doing some speculation, like that there was a fire of some sort. You know, that the people were dead. It's just, it's such a weird situation to have to be put into to speculate about something that you really have very little information on.
I still haven't seen the data.
I did see that someone on CNN asked whether there was any, you know, how come we're not looking at possible supernatural explanations?
Yeah, I heard that on.
Gee.
It was on NPR. They played that clip. Mm-hmm. It's like, what? Oh, the talking heads.
Because, yeah, because that would explain the problem. So the plane was going along, and then.
Maybe they were the only ones
raptured.
That were raptured, yeah.
Well, what if you don't? What if you just go sci-fi with it? Maybe what happened is they actually went into a tear in the fabric of reality.
Wormhole? Yeah.
Yeah, and not even a wormhole, just some sort of weird tear in the fabric of reality. Mm-hmm. And they actually landed safely in a universe that is 99.999% just like ours. So they didn't notice, and their world didn't notice, but we noticed. They just went into a slightly different world.
Right. I like that one. That one's probable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why not? Because we've seen that happen in Endeavor.
Yeah, so I guess the last missing airplane of any, you know, that wasn't like private craft was in like 56 or something like that. So it's been quite a while.
It's been quite a, the last missing jetliner. Passenger mm-hmm. jetliner,
yeah,
has been quite a while. Although Air France was the one just recently was missing for about a year.
Okay, I didn't realize it was that long. I know that the Woods Hole guys, you know, did the diving to find it.
So, it's not unprecedented for something to be missing. Mm-hmm. It's sort of unprecedented for us to have really no idea about where it could possibly be.
Right.
I think the Air France one, they had a pretty good idea where it was.
Probably crashed on its flight plan or something like that, right? Not south of Australia. Jesus, it's way out there, man. It's way, way out there.
And that's just a possibility. I mean, it could be anywhere on that arc.
Yeah.
So, and that was just the last time they received the ping. So that's the last time it was powered. Was somewhere on that arc.
Yeah.
Interesting. Before we did the pre-show and Jeff was putting up the last show, Jeff played the Frozen soundtrack for me, or at least a couple songs from
it. Yeah, just two and a half songs.
Because you've been listening to it for a while?
Been listening to it quite a bit around the house, yeah. Talk about earworms for me.
It was pretty terrible. I kind of understand why people like it. It's very, like I said, very American Idol, right? I mean, the songs themselves are pretty lavish, kind of musical-like productions. They remind me of certain Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals and things like that.
Yeah. The lyrics are terrible. I mean, I think the music is well written. You know, I mean, I'm comparing it to many of the other Disney movies that I've been watching, right? Mm-hmm. If I had to hear Hakuna Matata as much as I've heard Let It Go, I would have stabbed both my ears out by now.
But like I said,
but the lyrics, they're just crazy, ridiculously weird, poorly written lyrics in like many of the songs.
I mean, yeah, in a musical, you want your lyrics to be good. I don't think that all music has to have great lyrics. I'm a fan of the voice as an instrument theory.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as there's a cadence, right, then that's especially true in things like rap where your cadence says a lot. I mean, if it's clever lyrics, then that helps.
I don't know if I'm elated or gassy, but I'm somewhere in the zone.
That's just a silly line. I'm fine with that. It was just it was the rest of the the stuff that the subtle pandering to silliness, I guess you could say. It was really, really just poor. I haven't had enough time to think about how I would define it, but just poor. Okay, what else?
One best song.
Yeah, and that makes you think, what were the other songs? That one best song. There was a recent story about the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
This is it's actually a pretty complex thing that I don't fully understand, but it has to do with polarization of light in the cosmic microwave background. So polarization of light is actually really simple to understand. Light waves, light's a wave, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where the in 3D space the dimension that is oscillating on is this polarization. So this I'm doing up and down, that's a vertical polarization. I'm doing left to right, that's a horizontal polarization.
Right.
That's polarization. In what they were searching for in this study was the polarization of light. So the idea is that in the inflationary period, that's when these sort of bumps and stuff in mm-hmm. the cosmic microwave background were defined. And in essence, most of the light should be polarized kind of in one, in pretty much any way. But some of the light had to go through some of these bumps. And so it should be polarized in a very specific way. And this was the detection of some of those, of some of that light being polarized in a very specific way in those bumps. Why is this meaningful? Well, there's been lots of things saying it proves the Big Bang is true. Not any more than we already knew, right? I mean, it proves the model has a lot of legitimacy to it, the Big Bang model. It doesn't prove there was a Big Bang so much as it proves that the inflationary model seems to fit the data.
Mm-hmm.
Inflation is a very interesting period. So this is when the universe it went from about, so I'm going to say 10 to the negative 42 seconds to 10 to the negative 36 seconds or something like that. It's in that range. The universe expanded by a factor of 10 to the 90. So
in like no time at all.
In no time at all.
It expanded by a area bigger than you can imagine.
Not bigger than you can imagine. It went from roughly the size of an atom to about the size of a basketball.
Oh, okay.
If you were
the size of,
yeah, but that's a huge amount. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's a ridiculously huge amount okay. to expand in 10 to the negative 35 seconds, right? I mean, that's, and then it continued expanding from there. You know, by the rest of the second, it was already
mm-hmm.
probably bigger than the observable universe. But the point is that one expansion was huge. The inflation was brought in as a way to explain the homogeneous nature of the universe. The thing is that, you know, everyone has probably seen the cosmic microwave background picture. It's an oval because it's shaped that way because it's the projection of a sphere. But some areas are sort of redder and some areas are greener in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Those are areas of very, very tiny temperature variations. Very tiny. Extremely tiny. So tiny that you certainly would notice them if you're in the room with that. But enough that we can see the temperature variations. But the thing is that if the universe didn't have this rapid period of expansion, there wouldn't be an explanation for why the universe looks the same in every direction. You would expect there to be some, you know, a big clump here and a big bunch of nothing there. But the idea is that it was all sort of clumped up together, so there was time for it to reach a relative equilibrium in temperature before it inflated. That's where the idea of inflation came from. And it was kind of dropped in there to explain things without having a particularly good evidence. It was just the math sort of worked and it worked out. This is evidence that it actually happened. This is sort of the second big discovery or confirmation in as many years about something that we kind of dropped in there as an explanation because it tended to make the math work, and it turns out to be true. The first was the Higgs, and this is inflation.
Yeah, so I saw a tweet It was on, I don't know if it was Space Flight Now, Science. I meant to click the link, but it was during work day. And it was, you know, you're talking about this stuff. This has to be tied into the gravitational wave stuff that was just
This is evidence of gravitational waves.
Right. But the tweet was, gravitational waves are not gravity waves. Oh. And I didn't get to see, so I was just searching to see if I could find the story to kind of get a little bit about that. And, because gravity waves were the things that we were trying to look for.
We're trying to detect those via LIGO and other things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's probably a distinction between what I'm suspecting they would say is there a distinction between a sort of quantum gravity and a large scale relative Einsteinian gravity. What this also shows, though, is it shows that if the model is correct, then gravity absolutely has an effect on the quantum realm.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who were assuming, you know, not everybody, but, you know, there was a small group of people who were saying that maybe gravity is purely an Newtonian phenomenon and it doesn't actually have a quantum analog. But it appears that there is a quantum analog, because this can only happen, this sort of polarization effect can only happen if there is gravity on those quantum scales. Some type of gravity.
Yeah. Oh, I can't seem to find it right now. Anyway, so if you get some free time, I want to look into that. That could be an interesting differentiation. Because if you just search for this, like the results I'm getting back, people are interchanging gravitation and gravity waves. So,
well, again, take what I say about this with a grain of salt. This is not something I really know a whole lot about. I wish I knew more cosmology because it's very interesting and it kind of relates to particle physics. It's not quite the same thing, but it is kind of, because what they're doing in the LHC, for example, is trying to recreate the type of conditions that were there at the Big Bang. So that's how it all ties together. But it's interesting stuff if you ever get into it, but it's not something that like I could ever give a lecture on. At least not now.
If you can't give a lecture on it, you don't know it.
Exactly. I don't know. Is there anything else going on?
I don't know. Stuff.
Things.
And that. Golly, I don't know. I've been so busy with the kids and everything that I haven't been quite. Oh, I bought a TV today.
Oh.
It's going to be delivered on Tuesday. It's not here yet.
What kind of TV?
Samsung.
The kind that you watch?
Kind that you watch. 60 motherfucking inches plasma, because it's going to be down here in the dark room. There's not very many plasmas being made. I think the guy at Best Buy, I'm not sure. You can almost never trust what the guys at Best Buy say.
Absolutely not.
But he wasn't telling me product information. He was just telling me that no one makes plasmas anymore other than Samsung. And I said, I think Vizio might. Now, I'm not saying that means I want to buy a Vizio. I'm just saying, I think Vizio might.
Now, the question is, do plasma still have a burn-in problem? I think they still do, so you have to watch that.
Keep an eye for that. Yeah. I can see why plasmas are dying and dead. The two plasmas that they had at Best Buy on the display today, they look like shit in the showroom compared to LEDs, right? Because plasmas are good for dark rooms, right? Low light, you know, because the blacks are best. And where I'm putting it down here, it's perfect, right? It's a perfect plasma room. But, you know, big box showroom does not treat plasma as well. Yeah. No one who doesn't know that they want to get a plasma for their home theater is going to pick these plasma TVs that are on the wall. Yeah. They looked significantly worse than the LEDs all around them.
Isn't that weird how that, you know, that sort of showroom thing has affected the way in which technology has evolved?
Well, I mean, but I think it almost had to have, right? Yeah. I mean, no one's buying plasmas, so no one's making plasmas. And which means no one will be able to buy plasmas after that.
Did you buy it at Best Buy or did you go online?
I actually got it at Best Buy because of the 18 months no interest financing.
But you could have bought it at Best Buy online and got that, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I didn't. they're still going to deliver it, but I was looking, they also had a 51 inch and I wanted to see if I wanted to go with the smaller 51 inch versus the 60. So I went so I could actually see the sizes.
I mean, there's the problem that a lot of these big box stores and even Best Buy now is having issues. People are buying more stuff online. So those big box stores are kind of going away, but they are great showrooms. A lot of people go to these places, find something they like, and then buy it online for a, for a better price.
TVs, there's like the manufacturer like has a holdback price or something. You know, they set limits on what can be sold and things like that. So there's not much variation. I did a lot of looking on Amazon, and Amazon just wasn't competitive to the discounted Best Buy and Walmart pricing. Problem with Walmart TVs is they're all special spins for Walmart to keep the price down, and they cut out inputs. So, like, the TV that Best Buy or that Amazon is selling might have two HDMIs, a composite, and a component. The same TV that Walmart sells, but with a slightly different model number, but still, it's just spun for Walmart, they cut out the component video and the composite video, so it only has two HDMIs. You know? Like, there was a TV at Walmart that was a good price. I'm like, I would get this if it had all the inputs it's supposed to have. You know?
Nowadays, most, you know, in 5 years, you're not going to find anything with a component. You'll have to get a box for it.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, I still have the Xbox. That's the main reason I want the component. The Wii, you know, it comes with a component or composite cable. We actually, I ordered a component video cable for the Wii. That was a cheap one. If you wanted the HDMI convert for the Wii, it was expensive, right? My stereo receiver, I'm not replacing the receiver or anything. The receiver doesn't have HDMI. I'm good right now with the two HDMIs. I'll hook up the cable box. Actually, the XBMC will be hooked up to one of the HDMI ports. The other HDMI port will either be the cable box or the Roku. I'm not positive yet. And then and go from there. Probably not the Roku. Probably keep the Roku up in the bedroom. But
imagine what you'd do if you bought a Nintendo today and you wanted to hook it up to your
computer. What about that Atari 2600 that's sitting in the drawer right back
there?
Yeah,
what can you do with that?
Because that had the thing that goes into the screws for the antenna.
Right? The 80 ohm thing.
Well, I mean, that's... No, that was Nintendo. The Atari, right? The Atari had the... had the little metal square box, right? With the two little fork things, right? Kind of like what you're thinking. But on the other side, so you unhooked your antenna from your TV, and this went in line. So you hooked the two up to your TV, and you hooked the antenna on the back, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's a little switch saying game or antenna. And I mean, I don't know. I would have to buy some specialized piece of equipment to get that Atari. I don't even know if it still runs, right? But to get that Atari running, see the games right there in that red bag?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there's an Atari 2600 there with a stack of games. You know, I got all the main ROMs, right?
I bet you could either find something on eBay or find the instructions to create something.
Yeah, you could probably make something, actually. Yeah, I don't know what it would cost. Probably it'd be cheaper than an HDMI converter.
Right, yeah.
You know, because... Well, as long as your TV still has a coax input. If it doesn't have a coax input, then it's going to get a lot more expensive, I bet.
Right, and then you have to deal with some sort of circuitry.
You're still sticking with RF. You're just kind of probably changing some impedances and things like that.
Right.
Once you have to change it from RF to...
You have to do digital. You have to do some kind of...
Or even to, you know, S-video or something like that. Like, nothing is S-video anymore, but if you have to go from RF to S-video, I'm sure there's some difficulty there.
Because you have to change your thing to luminescence and chrominescence, which is what S-video is.
Well, there's that. Or even component or composite, right? The yellow plug.
That's composite.
Even with just that yellow plug, right? You know, because the RF has audio and video, right? So you have to split that out, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I might have to look someday. I don't know if that thing still runs. It hasn't been turned on in, you know, probably 15, 20 years. So
that shouldn't stop it.
Well, some of the components kind of get...
Sometimes it can...
Capacitors go bad,
but it doesn't... It, not always.
Mm-hmm. It's probably pretty easy to make service, actually. There's probably lots of big solder.
You know? I'm sure.
There's probably lots of big, you know, through the hole type components on there.
The processor itself shouldn't really go bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got all the MAME ROMs, though. Why would I really...
Now you can get the Atari in a joystick.
They've had that for years, right? It was just a joystick with a component or a composite video out, right? And it had, you know, 15 games on it or whatever. Today, it could have all the games.
I saw that with a Genesis in the store once. It had a Genesis controller, and that was it. And it had everything inside of it, like 200 games or something like that.
You could even build that on your own, because like a Raspberry Pi could play Atari games, you know?
I mean, sure.
I mean, you could definitely do it on your own. Maybe that'll be a project. Take the Atari controller, stick a Raspberry Pi in there, load it up.
Have
all
you
the main
seen
ROMs.
The guy who made a homebrew Atari portable?
No. It sounds vaguely familiar. Is it new or old?
No, it's old.
It's old, yeah. It's
at least 5 or 6 years probably at this point. But, you know, he got a little LCD screen and he built the thing and he made it look like an Atari thing. It's really, and you can put cartridges in it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. But one of those things that it's like, how often do you really play Atari games? Not very often. I mean, can you imagine? You probably have, I guess, shown an Atari game or two to Allison.
I haven't. I haven't turned on my... I probably should turn on the Xbox to keep those caps exercised so that thing doesn't go bad. I haven't turned on my Xbox in probably 2 years now. But yeah, I should, all the iOS games that she's playing now, you're like, here, check out this. This game's called Adventure. You're this square and you're running around and there's this seahorse thing that's supposed to be a dragon.
Show her, Combat is still a great game.
No, there's good Atari games for sure.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. They had to make the games good. Because they couldn't rely on graphics.
Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't have to make the games good.
No, they didn't have to. But the games that have lasted, the games that are in our perceptions, are either the ones that were absolutely fucking terrible or the ones that were great.
Missile Command.
Yeah. The ones that are essentially timeless concepts. Because, you know, it was the concept of the game that really worked well. So, you know, Combat is great. Space Invaders.
Missile Command. Just...
The version of Pac-Man was terrible, so you can show her that.
Yeah, it was still Pac-Man though.
You can show her the ET game, which was
Pitfall.
Pitfall, fantastic game.
There was a thing with Pitfall with Activision games where if you scored a certain score, you took a picture of the score and you sent it in, they'd send you a patch. And my mom had scored a good score once, took a picture. I had scored a decent score, took a picture. She gets the roll of film developed, and the picture looked like the TV was off. It happened to snap it, in between refresh rates or something like that. Or, it was probably her old 110 film. Remember the ones that had the little, looked almost like a cassette tape, like with the, not cassette tape, but like two reels. It was a cartridge that had two reels and kind of like...
I only remember the one reel.
35 millimeter type thing. Millimeter. No, so 110. It was. I'll draw it to scale even. So from the top view, it was that big, and then from the side view, it was like this. Okay, that was the cartridge.
Oh yes, I do.
That was
remember
the cartridge.
Those. Yes.
So and basically, yes, there was a shutter here, and this is where the film got exposed, right here, and that was the.
Those are like kitty cameras. Yeah.
That was the camera my parents had.
Those were easy to load.
Had growing up. And, so something with, there's no manual controls. You couldn't do a longer refresh rate.
That's amazing, the things that we used to film.
I would just take a shot of a TV screen so you can get a patch from Activision.
And you didn't know about your picture until you got it developed. I mean...
Well, that's most of history has been that way.
I know it's most of history, but it seems so anachronistic even to us who grew up with it. Even to my parents, it seems anachronistic.
Yeah.
It's weird the way that when technology really gets a hold of you, it gets a hold of you completely, and you you don't even think about when it was like when it was different.
Right.
But yeah, remember Photomat? There used to be Photomats, little things in parking lots that were just there for you to develop your films.
The one that's right by where Whole Foods is, there was a Photomat there, and that's where we got our film developed. We had to go all over there. You know, that's where we got our film developed.
Oh, man.
Yep. The Photomat building was there for quite a while. It was a coffee shop, like a drive-through coffee thing after that. Mm-hmm. Then I think Starbucks moved in and that kind of killed that. And
Or
Starbucks moved into the neighborhood. Well, Starbucks moved into the neighborhood, right? There's a Starbucks right there. That probably pushed out whatever was there.
Yeah, that form factor had a purpose for a while, but especially in the internet age, there's no point in having that.
I was at Disney, right? And in the souvenir shop, they had film, you know, disposable film cameras for sale. I'm like, I didn't know you guys were selling antiques here.
Yeah, I've seen disposable digital ones.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't. I mean, Disney, you know, with all the technology and stuff, I was surprised that they had. Maybe they want to keep a price point low, but that doesn't sound like a theme park either, right? You know, I'm surprised they don't have. They didn't have disposable, you know.
Well, I bet you can make those for like
20 cents.
Yeah, something like that. And then you sell them for $4, you make a huge profit, right?
$4. Try like $15.
Wow. So yeah, I bet you could buy 100 of those for less than it costs to buy one of those at Disney.
Yeah. Yep. Film cameras. Anyway.
All right, that's enough for the pre-show. Let's head on. Oh, well, I'll mention the potion.
You do that.